Greetings, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea. This is Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett, and to the hostile invading alien armies hovering silently behind their cloaking devices. Remember, eat the Canadians first. And there is, you know, one of those weather shifts that were long overdue. I was talking to a friend in Portland, and he was getting, you know, baked. And I don't mean that in the way that we used to mean it when we were talking in college. He used to say, "I'm getting baked this weekend." He thought he lost a tree, like this beautiful old tree on his property from heat shock. And it was really bumming him out. And that was going on a lot, which means it was also happening up in Canada, too. As you know, in our northwest is their southwest former furthest corner. And they were getting it just as bad there. So they went from being very tasty Canadians to being very toasty Canadians. But it seems like everything's a little copacetic this weekend. Maybe some more rain keeping things even for a while. Don't know what the weather's like these days in Newport, Rhode Island, but I know that our first guest this hour is going to be there. We'll tell you more about your chance to meet Peter Lance in just a moment. Next hour, we're going to talk about brain hacking. I'm so excited about this. Dr. Bart Kosko, who is a professor of electrical engineering as well as a JD, he has a law degree as well, and he is a speculative writer. He's a very dimensional thinker. He is ready to go with all of us into that furthermost scary, you know, edge of where we think we could be going with brain hacking, with implants, with Gertrude the pig, with what Elon Musk has been proposing, with what many people are saying is the future perhaps of print or communications, journalism in general, is somehow just information that is automatically beamed into the brain. And you think, well, I don't want that, so that's fine, and I think I don't want that either. But how soon could that be coming before we even have a chance to say no? And are there upsides to that that we can't imagine? What is brain hacking? If you don't know, we'll get to all of that coming up next hour. Plus, he's the author of a book called Cool Earth, which is such a funny idea. He doesn't present, it's not a comedy, but he wrote this book, Cool Earth, and I've been reading it all day. And it's based on the premise that, you know, perhaps we have to find an inventive solution to global warming. And you'll never believe just exactly what that is until we get to that coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Last night's show on the Jim Morrison theories was so entertaining, thanks to our guest, Michael Christopher. And we put a lot of the comments up. I was sort of following people who were suggesting bumper tunes and other stuff. Great covers for Doors songs at Deacon Punnett, my Twitter handle. And of course, after I got off the air, like 20 really terrific covers came up that I'd never heard of before. So I thank everybody who sent them in. I'm just going to have to bank those later on for when and or if we ever get John Densmore on. I would love to get him on to discuss his reflections on the Doors on one of those Friday nights when we do pop culture on Coast to Coast AM. All day I was looking for my copy of Homicide at Rough Point, the untold story of how Doris Duke, the richest woman in America, got away with murder. And I was looking next to my bedstand. I was looking in my, I had the library cabinet I was looking for. I was looking for books that were next to my desk. Couldn't find it. I sit down to do the show tonight, and boom, there it is. It was right where I left it last time Peter Lance was on the air with us. Good evening, Peter.
Hey, Ian. So great to be with you.
Well, I have a question that's more of a process question I want to start with, which is, I understand that you are the author in residence at the Brenton Hotel in Newport, Rhode Island for the better part of July. And I'm just curious, how did you score that gig?
Well, I did a number of Zoom book club meetings throughout the spring. You know, the book came out on the 23rd of February, and did really well. You know, it's in four editions, hardcover trade, Audible, which I narrated, believe it or not.
I believe it.
And a paperback. Yeah. And so anyway, been doing, chugging along, doing well, and getting a ton of press in the LGBTQ plus media because Eduardo Torello, the victim of Doris Duke, who was murdered, was happened to be gay. But it's had a strong following. In one of these Zoom meetings with in Barrington Books, the woman at the end that ran it suggested, you know, Peter, there are a lot of Tony hotels in your hometown of Newport, Rhode Island, a number of new ones, in fact. Why don't you approach them? Because it turns out, Ian, that artist in residence is a thing, and now increasingly author in residence is a thing, wherein fine artists are like in residence, if you will, at a given hotel, and they have their artwork on the walls, or they appear and they paint or sculpt. And apparently this is happening with authors. So I just approached the hotels in town, and the Andy Ross, who's the managing director of this beautiful new boutique hotel, 57-room hotel on the Inner Harbor in Newport, he responded immediately, and we worked it out. So they put the hardcovers in their really high-end rooms. They put the trade paperbacks in the other rooms. And then at least once a week, I come down to this second floor place called the Living Room, and I hold forth to the degree that I'm able and answer questions about how I did the investigation, et cetera. And it's worked out really, really well. In fact, we had a podcast the other night, my third installment with a guy named Bill Bartholomew, has like one of the most successful ones in Southern New England. And he taped it there or recorded it, whatever the term is now.
Right.
And anyway, so it's been really great.
Well, I love that for you. And I think it's awesome that you have it. I'm guessing then, because you said the Breton Hotel is new, that this was one of the places where you did not at any point mow their lawn or serve as a busboy or the pool boy or anything when you were a kid growing up in Rhode Island.
No, it actually opened in the middle of 2020. And, it, you know, like so many places Yikes. That opened then, it was quite a dicey period. I'm sure I did something in the environs when I was younger, though. I mean, you know, I covered the waterfront, if you will, in Newport back then. So,
yeah,
it's great. It's just really cool. But there's a new development that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you tonight. There's a stunning, stunning new development. You know, it's not often when you put a book out that multiple months later something comes to fore on in a true crime story like this that actually could be a major breakthrough in the historical record and the story itself. So that's why I wanted to talk to you tonight. Well,
and so we shall. So, I mean, I was interested in just looking for like a couple of quick sentences to encapsulate the book Homicide at Rough Point, and especially for people who didn't know Doris Duke. And I went to the Doris Duke page on Wiki, and I was not surprised to see that you were quoted there. But it was nice to see what a fat paragraph you got, and a nod toward the original version of this book, which appeared as an article in Vanity Fair. So let me ask you, if you would, before we get to the development, for people, and you know, Doris Duke is one of those things that, one of those names you hear, or you hear about her philanthropy, and so explain the real, both the fascinating celebrity life that she led, but also the darker side of Doris Duke.
Yeah, okay, so Doris Duke was born in 1912. At the age of 10, she inherited $50 million, making her the richest girl in the United States and third richest in the world behind Queen Elizabeth and Queen Juliana. She was the recipient, the beneficiary of a fabulously wealthy fortune, which combined the fortunes of American Tobacco Company. Essentially, her father created the modern cigarette as we know it, Lucky Strike, among other brands. Then Alcoa Aluminum, and ultimately Duke Power back then, which is now Duke Energy, which operates in multiple states. Fabulously wealthy. Her father on his deathbed, James Buchanan Duke, said, trust no one. And she was notoriously paranoid ever since. She sued her mother at like, I think, the age of 12, the first of 40 lawsuits in her life. She was notoriously vindictive, notoriously stingy. She had four major estates, Duke Farms in New Jersey, 2,500 acres. Falcon Lair, the old Rudolph Valentino estate in Benedict Canyon, right across from where Sharon Tate was killed. And my book actually opens with an incident in which Sharon Tate interacted with her months before her death. Then there was Shangri-La, this beautiful estate, Islamic-themed estate in Diamond Head, Hawaii, a Park Avenue penthouse. And then, of course, Rough Point in Newport, Rhode Island, which is located at the end of Bellevue Avenue, what they call Millionaire's Row. And Newport, for those who have never been there, was the summer playground of the robber barons during the Gilded Age. In fact, they just shot a program with Julian Fellows, who's behind Downton Abbey, and it's going to be on HBO, called The Gilded Age. They shot much of it in Newport. So there are these incredible mansions, summer cottages, et cetera. So Doris Duke, in 1966, had her longtime designer, artistic curator, was a man named Eduardo Torella, happened to be gay, her constant companion for 7 years. He designed and curated most of the art that was in Rough Point and her other estate. She never bought a piece without him. And he told her at this last minute that he was leaving her. He had a big Hollywood career amping up. He designed sets for The Sandpiper with Taylor and Burton, had a new film with Sharon Tate. His career was taking off. His partner on the West Coast, Edmund Carr, was a well-known sculptor, had a great life in both Laurel Canyon and Big Sur. And everybody warned him, don't tell her, don't do this. So don't tell her you're leaving. Just do it by phone. And he said, oh, no, I can do it face-to-face. I can handle her. And the reason his friends were paranoid was that she had stabbed her common-law husband with a butcher knife, Ian, 2 years earlier when he made a crack about her piano playing. Joe Castro was this brilliant jazz musician, and she grabbed a butcher knife and slashed his arm 150 stitches and covered that up. I mean, he never went to the hospital. It was never reported to the police. After he sued her for assault and battery, he was essentially kidnapped in Hawaii, Shanghai, held incommunicado till he renounced the suit. I mean, this is the way she rolled. And she had this whole battery of minions, lawyers, press flacks, private eyes that would go around and clean up after her troubled narrative or life. You know, in fact, that's what made my investigation of this case so difficult. So anyway,
but hold on a second there, because I think that stands in contrast to something that, and it's interesting because having read the book and knowing a little bit about Doris Duke, that just what you said was kind of the star that she was told to steer by, trust no one. She still had this very reckless side in terms of romances and, you know, the celebrities that she slept with and some of the other people that she would have had to have had both money and influence, the juice that she needed to keep all those stories quashed.
Oh, absolutely. And so she had unlimited resources to do that. Yeah, she had a voracious sexual appetite. She had affairs with every alpha male from Marlon Brando to George Patton. She was and many beautiful women as well. So she was a female buccaneer in many regards, the way she rolled. But she had the money to take care of it all, if you will. All the things you see in movies about how rich people in small towns that dominate the towns, you know, own the police, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right.
This was Doris Duke on steroids, particularly in Newport, Rhode Island, which at the time this incident happened, and they for years have called it an accident. The Newport police ruled it an accident. And tonight, the earth-shattering discovery that I made in the last week at the Brenton Hotel, by the way, is the value of just being on the ground, Ian, in a place and talking to human beings, right?
Right.
Anyway,
But I want to go back to the one of those lovers was the there were cool things about Doris Duke, the first non-Hawaiian woman to learn how to surf from the most famous surfing family in Hawaii, and she was sleeping with one of the brothers, right? The guy who was like the world surfing champion.
She slept with the Olympic champion, Duke Kahanamoku. There's a puff biography of her that came out called The Silver Swan by Sally Bingham that came out in April of 2020. And she claims that she was friends just with one of the brothers. But Duke Kahanamoku was this legendary Olympic swimming champion and surfer, and he taught her how to surf the longboard. She was also an accomplished jazz musician, but she almost certainly got pregnant with a child by Duke, and he was, you know, very dark-skinned Hawaiian, and very late in her pregnancy, she was afraid that the word would come out. The guy she was married to, James Cromwell, was a Palm Beach WASP who had political ambitions, and she hadn't slept with him in months. So she went surfing on a very dangerous day and essentially miscarried the child, who was known as Arden. The baby died 24 hours later. And that spun Doris into a whole kind of mysticism part of her life, where ultimately she came to believe that a woman she later adopted as her daughter, Shandi Hefner, was the reincarnated Arden, her daughter. And of course, at the end of Doris's life, Shandi was not included in the will, or at least that was what was said at the time, and Shandi sued, et cetera. A lot of litigation at the end of Doris's life involving her butler, Bernard Lafferty. This part of Doris's life, the death of Eduardo Torello, the murder that she got away with, that I proved in this book, got almost no attention whatsoever.
Yeah, but that thing about that Arden reincarnated woman, and she had the belief that so much so that this was the reincarnation of her child, that she adopted the woman and then she renounced the adoption and then she cut her out of the will, but the woman still ended up walking away with what, $65 million or something?
I don't know the exact figure. She apparently got a beautiful estate in Hawaii. She was... I don't know what the legal theory is, because I'm not expert on that end of Doris's life. But, she ultimately was able to retrieve some funds because she was with Doris for many, many years and treated as her daughter by Doris.
Right. I think the legal theory is just, we can hold this up for a very long time and prevent this from going through, or you can pay it off, which is a little bit like what Doris Duke did in real life, but somebody did it to her estate in death. And in the end, what was Doris Duke's estate worth at the time of her passing?
I think
billions.
Well, she had left in excess of $1 billion, and her charitable foundation, the large one, is upwards of $2 billion. By the way, I don't want to ratify your theory of that's how Shandi was able to get a settlement. I don't think it's fair to say she got it because she essentially threatened them with continued litigation unless they settled. She may have won on the merits. I think it's fair to Shandi to say that.
And maybe. I've been through that a few times. I've seen that happen a few times. And it's regardless of whether it gets to the merits, it's just faster to just go,
It does often happen, but I'm your counselor here.
That's fine.
I'm your consigliere tonight, and I want to make sure you're protected. No, I'm still alive.
That's fine. I feel like I'm well within my First Amendment rights on a radio show to offer an opinion. But I appreciate what you're saying. So, and I'll get to, because we'll get the break in before the revelation, but this is the kind of meticulous work that you always do. As a journalist, you try to always stick to the facts as you know them. And yet you're also then sort of dependent on people coming forward with facts. So before you tell us what it is that you've uncovered, explain how you already feel that you were certain that you could prove, just on the basis of things that you had uncovered about the photographs and about measurements and about speed and the gates and everything else, that Doris Duke had murdered this guy who had been her art curator.
You always set me up brilliantly, Ian. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, in other words, how do I prove circumstantially more than 50 years later that Doris Duke murdered this individual with intent, that it was not just manslaughter gone wrong or an accident, as the police concluded? I have to go do a spoiler alert for people who haven't read the book and tell them they're going to hear what really happened. But in order to explain this new development, I really have to tell what happened. So what happened was that moments after Eduardo Torello, and again, this is contained in my book, Homicide at Rough Point, Eduardo Torello, who's 42 years old at the time, on the edge of a new life, literally, in Hollywood, was just told her minutes earlier that he was leaving her. Now, he'd asked her to rent a station wagon, so she rented a 1966 Dodge Polara two-ton station wagon from the Avis dealership in Newport. He told her he needed that to bring some paintings from the estate that he'd done down to his mother's house in New Jersey. But he intended to basically clean out his place at Rough Point, his room, and take off forever. And that's what he told her right away. So they're driving.
So you got to stand on by there, because that's where we take it right up to the break. We'll finish. If you didn't hear the show on with Peter the first time, we'll tell you more about what he was able to uncover. And then I can't wait to find out what's been verified, or at least what are the new crumbs that he's followed. And we'll get back to that coming up in just a minute. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So before the bottom of the hour there, Peter Lance was just talking about Eduardo Torella, who was the art curator who had been warned about not sort of, if you will, breaking up with Doris Duke, although they weren't romantic. He was gay, but they were companions and traveling companions. And she just didn't like people telling her that they were done with her. That was her job to tell that to them. And she had a poor humor about it the night that he brought a station wagon to load up the things so that he would never have to see her again and start his life over again on the West Coast. And that's just where Peter Lance was in that story before we get to the confirming details coming up. So Peter, finish that up. They get a rental car, this Dodge Polara station wagon. And theoretically, Eduardo Torella was driving, theoretically, right?
You know, in fact, he was driving. They were heading out to pick up what is kind of the MacGuffin of the story, the reliquary of Saint Ursula, who was a very famous saint, martyred in the 4th century, AD, theoretically, in the legend of the Catholic Church. And there was, in the Catholic Church, and as a former altar boy, I can say they have certain artifacts called reliquaries contain a bone of a saint, a relic of a saint.
Right.
And they were prized by robber barons because they represented the power of money over the divine. That's why they wanted them in their houses. So she bought this a year ago. It had been restored, and they were going out to pick it up. That's where they were heading out, in this empty station wagon at the time. Okay, so he had just told her that he intended the next day to fill up the station wagon and leave her. And they had what one of the people I spoke to called a wicked fight, in Newport terms. Well, anyway, so he's driving. She's in the passenger seat of this two-ton wagon. They come to the gates at Rough Point, which are about 12 feet high, 7 feet wide, massive wrought iron gates. He gets out, his little chain wrapped around the gates, to open them. When suddenly she slides over the driver's seat, makes four affirmative acts. She releases the parking brake. She puts it into gear. She slams down on the accelerator and, roars forward, and suddenly he literally turns, he looks at her, startled, and I'm giving you the money shot item here. He jumps up on the hood of the vehicle, which is a thing that people do when cars, it's a lizard brain thing that people tend to do to save their lives, right? So he's on the hood of the car, terrified. He broke his hip, but he's alive, and he's terrified, staring at her. She blows through the gates, bends these gates, knocks five of the little baluster rungs out, and then... suddenly stops. She hesitates for a moment. Okay, hits the brakes outside Bellevue, onto Bellevue. It's 80 feet wide, this street, Millionaire's Row. He rolls off, and then how many seconds went by? We don't know. He's clearly alive. He's clearly in distress. He's clearly calling to her, and she just decides to go for it, and she runs over him, crushing him, and drags him across the rest of Bellevue Avenue, hits a curb, knocks down 20 feet of post and rail fence, and ultimately hits a tree. The car is parallel to the estate across the street, and he is dead, dead, dead. All of his fatal injuries are upper body injuries above his waist.
Yeah.
And that, within 96 hours, the local police call it an unfortunate accident. She's the only living witness until now. And this is the big headline. And basically, they wrap it up, and they actually create a phony transcript which is, and I got a hold of the police report, the holy grail of my investigation, and in Chapter 7 of Homicide at Rough Point, I published this full three-page transcript in which the police absolutely made up, fabricated, in order to let her off and get away with murder, effectively. She then began giving money to the town and rescued Newport from near bankruptcy after Richard Nixon closed the naval base, or not closed it, but, you know, cut 21,000 right. jobs in Rhode Island. That's the story that was a legend for 50 years, the story that I drilled down on and through circumstantial evidence and the report and talking to a lot of retired cops who knew fragments of it. I put the piece together, first in Vanity Fair, now in this 438-page book, Homicide at Rough Point, same title. And then last Saturday, this amazing individual showed up at the Brenton Hotel while I was signing books and had a story to tell.
All right. Now, I want to point out, though, when I was saying theoretically, she always said that, I mean, she was the one who said, I moved over into the driver's seat and I accidentally, you know, I released the parking brake because I was going to try to move forward to let him in. But I hit, instead of hitting the brake, I really hit the accelerator. And she was saying, oh, what a terrible accident. It was a slip. It was a mistake. So she kind of copped to it, but she made sure it looked, you know, and dressed it up as something which was an innocent mistake as opposed to an intentional act. And as you point out, there were other things like how much gravel would have been kicked up, how fast the wheels would have had to have been spinning, how hard it would have, she would have had to have been, how fast she would have been going in order to get to the gate, that kind of thing. That's what you had previously been able to determine.
Yeah, except that her original story, Ian, was much more anemic than that. Her original story was, I moved over, we had done this 100 times before, he would get out, open the gates, I would drive through, and he would then close the gates, get back in, and we'd go on, right? Well, right. She had never done that before, according to her caretaker. And then she said, oh, the car just leapt forward, like, you know, out of a Stephen King novel, Christine, you know, like the car, right. She had no idea. She didn't talk about releasing the brake. That came later during a trial in 1971 where she was found liable for his death. But that was not the original story. The original story was, I slid over, suddenly the car leapt, and I was on top of him. And the police chief claimed he was crushed against the gates, which was an affirmative lie. The Newport right. Daily News the next day said that. So all of what I've told you is how it happened. And this, according to Fred Newton, the sergeant who was the chief accident investigator, and I got the police report and I put this together. That's been, and so the reason Wikipedia, by the way, and I really appreciated you pointing that out, they had never changed her page on Wikipedia in years. And after my Vanity Fair piece, I didn't do it. You know, I wouldn't even know how to do something at Wikipedia.
Right.
Somebody, you know, did a many, many paragraphs now on Eduardo Torella setting the historical record straight. And I'm very grateful for that because that's been the main intent of my book, to restore right. his reputation and tell the truth.
And that's when somebody walks into the Brenton Hotel and tells you what?
Okay, he says, Peter, a 68-year-old man, very authoritative in his demeanor and his, you know, tone. He said, Peter, I was her paper boy that night. And I was a little surprised because I quote a guy named Steve May in the book as being the paper boy on the avenue of Bellevue Avenue. But it turns out Steve, you know, delivered to several mansions kind of north of Rough Point. But he was that night, he happened to hear the crash and then he doubled back and reported it. And that's how the police were ultimately summoned. So when he said, I was your paper boy, I went, what do you mean you were her paper boy? And then he said, no, I was actually the paper boy. I approached her estate every day from the South. I delivered the Newport Daily News. And he said that evening, now let me give you the beats real in rapid succession of what he told me there. And then I took him the next day, last Sunday, to Rough Point. I shot video of him. And every time he tells the story, he's spot on, consistent, and it's quite visual when you see the video. So he said that he was on the corner of Ledge Road, which is right around the corner from Rough Point, and I estimate it's probably 50 to 75 yards as the crow flies from the gate where all of this happened. And by the way, he pointed out back then in 1966, it was very quiet. There were very few cars at that time of the day. You could hear things, and rarely did people raise their voices in this area outside of their mansion. So he said, the first thing I heard was the sound of a man and a woman arguing. Okay. Next thing, and then now he quickens the pace. He's on a bicycle, kind of heading up to Rough Point to deliver the paper, but intrigued by what he's hearing. Next thing I heard was a rapid acceleration of an engine. Then I heard a sound of a crash of some kind. Then I heard the man, like his voice, kind of in distress. Then I heard a deacceleration. I heard a slight skidding sound. Then I heard the man more distressed. This is presumably when Eduardo rolled off. And then finally, as I got like literally to the point where I could almost see the crash point, I heard, no! And then I hear this car just crash, the sound of a crash. So he gets literally every single beat of the Fred Newton theory of the crash, this guy heard auditory-wise, okay? He then gets to the estate, to the service gate, which is down from the main gate where it happened. He shoves the dutifully shoves the paper in the slot where he delivers it. And he turns, and here's what is so startling. Doris Duke was found by the first arriving officer in the car, apparently in shock, apparently with cuts and, you know, abrasions to her nose and cuts to her lips, and in shock. And then when this first officer, Edward Angel, got there, who I interviewed, he said, I looked down and I said to her, oh, there's somebody under the car, at which point she jumped out and was hysterically running back and forth, apparently in shock, on Bellevue Avenue. A young Navy nurse came up to the scene and, like, to tend to her while this officer trying to look under the car to see if this person was alive. And then Doris took off running for the estate, and the nurse followed her. She went up to the second floor. Eduardo, Eduardo, she's calling out as if she didn't know where he was. This kind of fit with this theory of the car just leapt forward, you know? And,
right.
And then finally she came back, and then the police arrived and the ambulances, et cetera, et cetera. That's the story up until now. So this, I'm calling him the paper boy, 68 years old. He now turns and he can see the car crashed against the tree, and he can see Doris deliberately get out of the car, take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps, and then turn, not and face the car, not in shock, not, oh my God, what have I done? You know, but standing there, rod solid, straight, and looking under the car as if to see any proof of life, any signs of life. Who knows what she would have done if he was still alive.
Right.
Anyway, this paper boy then comes up behind her in his bike, and then he walks up behind her. It gets off the bike, and it's click, click, click. It's a 10 speed. And then she suddenly spins around and looks at him. Now, this guy was a former, and I have verified this guy's resume. Today, I spoke to multiple parties he told the story to in the early 70s. But he was a Boy Scout. He was an altar boy. His father taught him the code is you help people when they're in trouble. And particularly if it's a woman, you help the woman, okay? So he looks up at her, even though, you know, he's 13 years old. She's 6'2". And he says, ma'am, can I help you? And he didn't know actually it was Doris Duke. He knew he delivered the paper to Rough Point, but didn't know for sure who it was. And she screams at him, you get the hell out of here. She points at him with her finger, and he's taken aback, and he's stunned. Ma'am, would you like me to go up into your estate and call for help? Again, you get the hell out of here, in increasing tones of ferocity and anger. And finally, he said, would you like me to call the police? You get the hell out of here. And by then, and by the way, he also told me she was ghosting him, as he said. She was crab walking back and forth in front of the car as he was trying to look underneath, because it occurred to him that he had heard a man's voice, but there was no man, okay? So now, finally, he just says, okay, you know, and he goes and does his last couple of deliveries to Belcourt Castle and several other places. He goes home. His father told him to get dinner ready that night. His father really didn't want to hear what he had to say because he was the oldest of 9 children. But the next day, Ian, when he cut, we all had wire cutters. I was a Daily News delivery boy myself,
sure,
the less august part of town.
Right.
You wire cutters, you cut the bail. He sees the article. He tells his father slams him against the wall. You tell nobody this, your brothers, your sisters, your friends, et cetera. Why? Later, his father confessed when he was 18 and about to go in the Marines, son, this woman, I knew she was capable of anything, Doris Duke. And if I was worried that you'd be pedaling your bike one night, because you would have been the best fact witness if it went to trial as to motive, as to cover up, et cetera. I was afraid somebody would come up behind you in a truck and hit you, hit and run, and I'd lose my son. And only then did it really sink into him why his father had violated his own code and told him to shut up, okay?
That's but fascinating.
He told the story in the early 70s to two Marines that he was stationed. He was stationed in Washington, D.C. at Marine headquarters in the early 70s. He told it to two Marines, one of whom was a retired colonel. I talked to them today. He told three other people in Newport. I talked to them today. They all confirmed his story. He's an unflinching, one of the best witnesses, sources I've ever interviewed. He has such incredible credibility. And here's the most important thing. He went to the Newport police and made a full report the day before he reached out to me. And he would not, I believe, have done that if he was a poser or a faker or making up a story.
No, I mean, not least of which, I mean, I don't suppose after all this time there could be some, you know, charge or something if he was lying, but still it goes to his credibility that he was willing to do that before he came and talked to you as opposed to, you know, reverse order. So what does that mean for you in this story? I'm assuming there'll be another edition coming up with the book, but what does it mean now that we know his story? What do you do with that?
Well, the first thing, I reached out to my editor at Vanity Fair, who was intrigued but skeptical, as you might guess. Yeah. And then I said, listen, you've got to see the video of this man to fully appreciate this. I sent him like four video clips. I shot him telling the story, physically walking up and then standing in front of the, you know, I shot him in several angles on Sunday, last Sunday. And when I sent the first four videos, my editor was like blown away. And he said, I'm sending this to the editor, the deputy editor in chief of Vanity Fair, to see if we might do something with this. Have me write something up for the online, because it takes quite a while to get published in the mag. Right. And then he had the questions about, well, why didn't he ever come forward? Then I sent him his accounting to me of the story with his father, et cetera. And when he got those, he said, oh my God, this is absolutely, this man is so believable. And it alters history, Ian. So the first question to me is, why tell this story? Why continue to tell the story? Well, we know, this goes to your earlier question, there's no statute of limitation on murder. However, the perpetrator in this case is dead. She died in 1993. I have to check the law of the state of Rhode Island. You know, I have a law degree. I'm not a practicing attorney. But I want to find out what affirmative responsibility the law enforcement authorities may have, if any, to literally go in and investigate a case to tell the ultimate truth of a death, of a violent homicide, and what their responsibility is. But, you know, whatever it is, this officer, the cold case officer that he spoke to, seemed to take him seriously. She told him she had opened the case. And she right away, she called three of the sources that he gave her right away last Friday when he went to see her. So the Newport police at this point anyway appear to be taking this seriously. And this is the first time I'm like kind of talking about this nationally. But my hope is that whether it's Vanity Fair or I've also had many pieces done on homicide at Rough Point. And in Pride Media, the entity that has The Advocate and Out Magazine and Out Traveler, they've covered this book extensively because of Eduardo's, you know, that he was a gay man who was just, not only did he die, but Doris destroyed his reputation during that trial.
Right.
And he only got one line in her own New York Times sprawling three quarters of a page obituary. I think as a journalist, this is not as an author of a book. Just as a reporter, and I would ask you your opinion, I think this is news.
Oh, it's totally news.
If I can put this together, yeah, if I can articulate this properly in a piece for Vanity Fair or another publication, she was a world figure, Ian. She was an iconic figure, as you point out. Duke University was founded in the fortune behind her, you know, the three fortunes that she derived her funds from. Many people every week exercise in T-shirts and say Duke on them that have graduated, including Tim Cook, who was the chairman of Apple. You know, I mean, it's a very iconic American family name. And and there's one other thing that I need to try and rush to get into.
Yeah, you know, you don't have any time. You know, if you say it in 15 seconds, you got 15 seconds.
All right.
15 seconds.
The Home Museum just altered this exhibit they have from accident to incident and they cut a few other things, but it's not enough. But they've already begun to take some steps to address the truth.
I'll be curious to see whether the capital T, capital A, the authorities of today do better with it than the authorities did of the past when they already knew the truth. Thank you, Peter. Lance, so much enjoyed that update. Thank you for honoring it here on this show on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.